My name is Matthew Zapruder, and I am a graduate of Amherst College from 1989 and a poet and a former student of Stanley Rabinowitz's, Professor Stanley Rabinowitz. And we are here today to talk about a book that he translated by Russian dance critic Akim Volinsky called Ballet's Magic Kingdom, which was published by Yale University Press. And it's just an honor and a pleasure to talk to you about this book and ask you some questions and hear what you have to say. I won't say very much about Volinsky because I'd like to prefer to hear Stanley talk about him. But just briefly, the book, the collection is translations of both articles that Volinsky wrote for publication in newspapers and also a longer text called The Book of Exaltations, and we'll talk more in this conversation about the various characteristics of those pieces of writing. But the acknowledgments and introduction to the book do a great job, I think, of explaining your involvement in this project and who Volinsky is and what his relationship to dance in the larger Russian culture of the time of the early 20th century was. But I was wondering, for people who haven't had a chance to read the book yet, whether you might just briefly summarize, or not so briefly for that matter, summarize who Volinsky was, what this book is, and maybe talk about your involvement in it and how you got started.
I'd be happy to. One of the reasons I love doing the book is the more I did it and was involved in it, the more I realized that his life, to some extent, paralleled mine, or mine his. That is to say, he came to dance late in his career, just as I did. He came without any preparation. You'd never have predicted he would have done it for 13 years of his life, but he did. And in my own case, I got to this when I was in my, I guess, early 50s or very late 40s. So in some senses, there really is a parallel track here. I knew him, as most scholars and researchers and students of Russian literature knew him, in his early phase, which was in the 1890s, when he was a critic and an editor of a very well and highly regarded journal, which was published in Petersburg. He edited the journal for 8 years until it went out of business in 1898. And that's where we knew Volinsky. He wrote articles for the journal. He was very supportive of a new generation of writers who were starting to publish, and he took them in, and he edited their stuff, and he gave them a forum. And I didn't know, nor did anyone in my field, actually, that he had several lives after he gave up the journal. And so I got to know him because I was doing a piece on him as the editor of the journal. I was writing an article about it. I went to Russia in 1989, just after you graduated, Matthew, and I was there for 2 months. And I consulted his archive, which is in Moscow, although he lived most of his life in Petersburg. That's an interesting story, how it got to Moscow. And I was amazed at how much stuff is in there and the kind of material that is in there, unpublished, untouched. And one of the things I noticed was that for the last 13 years of his life, he was a very active critic on the dance scene. As a matter of fact, the major critic in Petersburg, and wrote for several newspapers, a very prestigious cultural journal. And then ballet became so much a part of his life that he opened a ballet school, he wrote a book, and when he died in 1926, shortly after the book was published, in 25, he was totally forgotten. And it was because people in the dance community in the West had heard his name that I got involved.
I guess I should have said before we launched into this, where we are, maybe. We're in the Russian Center here, and which Stanley is also the director of, in addition to his teaching duties. And it's a beautiful Sunday afternoon, and we're sitting and talking. It's nice for me to be back here. I was, as I mentioned before, Stanley's student in the late 80s here in Amherst College. And we're surrounded by valuable and beautiful Russian books and objects and artifacts. And so it's nice to be in this conversation, also moving back, you know, 100 years.
By the way, which Volinsky would very much have felt home in, this whole milieu, because if you see photos or read descriptions of his apartment or various apartments in Petersburg, he lived very sparsely. None of the beauty of the carpeting and the samovars of the center, but his life was filled with basically only books. And when you see pictures of his apartment, there are literal floor-to-ceiling bookshelves. He was extraordinarily erudite. He would have, as I said, delighted in all of the 19th century Russian literature that we have, and more. So that, to get back to him, he was a scholar, he was a critic, he was a thinker, and of course he was not only someone who was involved in the literary world, he was involved in Russian theater in the early 20th century. He wrote two books on fine arts. He wrote a biography of Leonardo da Vinci, which is extremely interesting and original. And at the end of his life, he wrote a book, which still has not been published, on Rembrandt, 500 or 600 pages. So he was one of these unique kind of encyclopedists who were truly Renaissance men. They were self-taught. He did not come from Petersburg. He came from a small Russian city called Zhytomyr. He was a lawyer. He went to law school in Petersburg. He had a degree, but decided not to practice law for a variety of reasons, and went into literature. And whatever he did was original and, in a way, quote, self-made. He had no formal training in any of this stuff. And whenever he decided to do it, he basically, in his usual way, I think we'll get into this later, he kind of took it over. He learned everything there was to know about it and then just spewed out all kinds of writing on literature, on theater, on philosophy, fine arts, and finally on dance, which is what we have here.
There are many, many, many wonderful things to talk about in this book. But I just want to say, I am not a person who has any particular interest in dance. I know almost nothing about it. And I know that from hearing you talk, give a wonderful public talk in San Francisco earlier, that you were not a particular dance enthusiast. I found myself immediately upon reading the book interested in classical dance, captivated by his descriptions, and also at least halfway convinced that ballet is intimately related to human experience and activities. And so the book itself, so as we're trying to give people a little bit of a sense of what it is much more than just... It's interesting because it talks about dance, which is interesting, an interesting subject like many subjects are. It's interesting because it gives a feeling for the early 20th century in Russia and these amazing, wonderful ballerinas, and I want to ask you about that later. But also, it talks about dance as an important human activity, and it's just not something that I had ever, to my detriment and limitations, had ever. And I know, so I just wanted to ask you.
Well, nor had I. We have the same response, and I'm delighted. And other people have had the same response, like you. I did not come to this project with not only a knowledge of dance, but to be honest, and I say this openly, with an interest in dance. I mean, it was only opera or classical music or theater that I really would spend my time frequenting. Dance was just not something that attracted me that much, certainly not classical dance. So the reason I got involved in this, and I did spend 13 years doing it, had very little, at least at first, to do with dance. It had only to do with his literary style, which I found captivating. Obviously, as a trained Slavist, I deal with literary texts and the use of language, and I found myself marveling at his extraordinarily poetic, rhapsodic, original use of the Russian language. Fascinatingly, because he does it so much better in this milieu than he does it in the other milieu, on theater or literature, and I have some ideas about that. And so I got so caught up in the writing. And then, of course, in his, as you mentioned, his ability to bring dance performance from the stage, from the immediacy of the stage, from that flickering moment where you are watching what is going on, to the comforts of your own home as you're reading, whether this came out in a newspaper and you're reading it at home or you're reading now the book, I found that was really attractive and exciting. It was only after I spent all of this time picking up the terminology and learning basically what he was talking about in order to translate it that I really did develop a much, shall we say, more respectful, more considered view of dance and the dance world. And again, I don't want to just go on and on and on, but one of the joys of seeing this book come out and be accepted the way it has been is to realize that it has had its greatest impact on people who love dance, although clearly you don't have to enjoy the book, because they feel, I think as you mentioned, that he gives the whole enterprise of dance such pride of place, such a central position in human expression, that people, whether they actually are the dancers or the choreographers or who knows, the costume makers, whoever, I've met a variety of people who've read this from the dance world, and they're enormously flattered. They think he does it right, and the fact that he does it is of an enormous compliment to them, and they really have a sense of validity. Well, gee, you know, valorization. Wow, you know, we're finally being recognized as one of the highest forms, if not the, of human expression. So he does all of that, and this is exactly what got me excited initially, and in the final analysis, what kept me going for all those years.
Well, I can only imagine, and we can talk about how difficult the translation project this must have been for a variety of reasons, but I just want to say that as I've been going through the book carefully and enjoying reading it, really ever since I saw you talk in San Francisco, my friends, many of whom are writers and poets, I am calling them up on the phone and reading passages aloud to them because it's so beautifully translated. And it's beautiful writing. It must be in the original, but it's so beautifully translated. And it's just such a pleasure to read the book.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you maybe if you would be willing to share with us a passage or two that you find particularly emblematic of his work.
Sure.
and maybe talk about maybe some of the pleasures and also difficulties in working with it, or to talk in general about this.
Start too. With the latter and then go to the reading, the former. There's something, this may be true in all exercises of translating. Certainly it was in my case. Translation, this is very deceptive. The original, I kind of like the English better than the Russian, which doesn't say anything about me. It just says that if you work at it hard enough, you can get it to a more readable state. Volynsky's language is really difficult. And Russians find, that is, let's put it this way, I think people who have read the book in English have a much more pleasant response to the language than Russians who read it in the original, because reading him in the original is really difficult.
That's fascinating to hear you say that, because I would not have thought the English prose is incredibly lucid, and I'm a perfect test case because I know nothing about what you're talking about. No. So if it were confusing, I would be confused.
The punctuation is different. Sometimes I had to compensate for that. His sentences can go on and on and on. As you know, he's very rhapsodic. He gets very carried away. In some senses, he has to be reined in. So you want to give the literal meaning of the prose. You want to convey the beautiful language, but you have to rein it in. And there's also some sort of more Germanic or Nietzschean quality to this writing. He was obviously an early 20th century thinker. They were all in Russia so much enamored of Nietzsche, these symbolists or pre-symbolist thinkers. And I have to say that probably the hardest thing in the project, or certainly the second hardest thing, first hardest was just to read it, understand it, try to literally translate it into Russian. I had to read these things to colleagues. They couldn't understand it. We had to go through it and through it because it's very technical at times. Once I got it into a readable Russian, then I had to put it into a smooth and readable English. And that took quite a while to do. You have to fine tune it and go over it. So, it was not necessarily, to tell you the truth, always pleasant. I don't know if the analogy is correct. I felt sometimes I was taking an ice pick. I had a block of ice and I had a pick and I just had to bang it and chop it and mash it to get it finally into the right form. It's, I think, very, pretty much very, very faithful to the original, but doing it was really a challenge. So that when you finally read it, of course, this is true with anything you like, it looks rather effortless. Oh, gee, that's fine.
That
it's a
is
nice
definitely
sentence.
How it feels.
But believe me, I tore my head out of my hair out of my head. I think I've said this. Here's a difficulty. I think you know this, Matt. I didn't realize this when I took on this project, that in Russian, the word for leg and arm is the same. No, I'm sorry.
Foot.
I'm wrong. Leg and foot. Leg and foot. Naga. The word for hand and arm is the same. So that when you're dealing with ballet, you better know whether it's the dancer's leg or the dancer's foot. And at times there are ways to compensate for this in Russian, and I had to learn that. But just on the level of individual word, this was a major challenge.
Well, I should say that, just to step back a bit, this book has been in two ways very successful and made a big impact. One is among, as you mentioned, dance professionals, people who care about that, and are but also among the general readership, there's been quite a wonderful critical response to this. I mean, I'm just pick one example was, and maybe we'll talk about this a little later, is the review by Bentley, Tony Bentley, in the New York Times, an extravagant praise of the book, and it's a testament to the translation, as you're talking about. But it's also true that there is, and to give people again a sense of what's going on here, there's very detailed, incredibly detailed descriptions, both of how one ought to dance and also of actual performances. So there's this kind of time capsule, historical aspect that's so wonderful about the book. And there's these amazing photographs of these ballerinas, and you start to get a sense of who these, you know, they were the NFL quarterbacks.
Well, that's right. They were the celebrities of the pinups of the day. That's
right.
Absolutely.
So all those
right.
things are all considered things that are come out of the success of the translation.
Yeah. You know? Well, I don't know if I'm going to be clear about this, but let me try. And again, I say to you, because Matt, you do this, so you might be sympathetic, or you certainly will understand what I'm trying to say. You know, we all come to a text, obviously, with different predispositions and different preparations. I very rarely, although I do have one or two occasions when I remember I did, I very rarely gave this text to someone in the field of dance to read in the original. Mm-hmm. I did one woman in particular. So that if I'm reading it, or if someone who is in another field other than dance is reading it, we may find it difficult or challenging or better or worse in very different ways than a person who is actually in the field who may pick it up and say, well, of course, I know the whole tradition of dance writing. So clearly this is terrible, or it's wonderful, or it's this or that. And one of the ways I operated to compensate for the fact that although I know the words, in different contexts, words mean very different things. So I may know the definition of word X in one context, but when you use that word in another context, in a dance context or in the context of athletics or sports, that same word means something else. It obviously means whatever the context has it mean. What I did, I think, which was extremely useful, instructional, and finally successful to finally render this into whatever English you have in front of you, was for years I was immersing my own self in ballet criticism written in English, just to get a feel for what the best ballet criticism judged to be the proper turn of phrase.
What did you discover in
reading it? Well, I read three. I read David Denby, I read Arlene Croce, and I read Joan Acacella. You can't get better than those, and I think Walensky was on their level. And I'm not sure I could tell you specifically, but I remember that what I got from them, and what I think you see here, is a flow of words, the kind of pacing, the kind of rhythm of the language when you write about dance. Walensky has it, but I could not see that on my own the way I ultimately did until I read, let us say, the equivalent in English.
I think that's a fascinating...
And then when I went back over my own translations, which you would do in any case, I would say, well, of course, this is too wooden. I mean, it's correct. It's what Volinsky is saying, but it may be what Volinsky is saying rendered by a person such as myself, who only reads literary criticism, mm-hmm. or only has a very narrow and specialized view of what criticism and what language can do on a page.
Do you think that Volinsky wasn't just interested in being descriptive? Obviously, his writing
That's
is
right.
incredibly prescriptive. Absolutely. It's both in terms of what he believes ballet, classical ballet, should do. He's very disapproving of in a very funny way, I find, of you know, certain famous figures. But also, so it's prescriptive in that sense, but it's also prescriptive in the larger sense that he's interested in the improvement of humanity in a way that is, I think, very out of character with current criticism, literary or popular or otherwise. Do you think that there's something that maybe that critics of, not just of dance, but generally critics who write for popular consumption might learn from this impulse in Volinsky? Maybe there's they could come a little way more towards mm-hmm. addressing themselves to more human concerns as opposed to just,
it's a good
I don't
question.
Know, I wonder
it's
what you think
question.
Of this.
It's complicated, I mean, and it's fraught with all kinds of dangers. First thing I would say is what I like about Volinsky, and I don't find all that much in contemporary critics, is his passion.
Mm-hmm.
It's unleashed, it is unapologetic, and at its worst, it's, you know, fierce, frenetic, and unforgiving.
Mm-hmm.
That's the downside. He took it so seriously. He was not afraid to put himself on the line and bare his soul.
Mm-hmm.
I found that very refreshing.
Mm-hmm.
He was he saw himself as, I'm afraid to say, a prophet. In one piece that I did not put in this volume, he basically said, I am happy that I have been called on, as if literally he was called on by a higher power, to come to Russia and explain dance. So there was this sense that he was doing someone else's work, that dance was, you know, a divine mm-hmm. Entertainment, higher than everyday life, and that he was the chosen prophet. He was a cheerleader. He was an ideologue. Even if he didn't agree with you, and if you read the book, you'll see even if he loved someone, he always found something nasty to say. He just felt, but you didn't mind that because he did it all in the service of what to him was just the highest form of expression. And whether it was literature in one incarnation or fine arts in another, and some of this was simultaneous, or dance, for him, as in a way for Nietzsche, life was an aesthetic experience, and that any kind of expression, of course, dance for him mm-hmm. became the ultimate, any kind of expression which had anything to do with the aesthetic expression of life was for him something he wanted to propagate. Do I feel that critics can do this now? Probably not. I think we live in a more, I don't know what, politicized or politically correct way. I'm not a critic in that sense. I find that some of the dance criticism I read does make me want to go and does make the reader want to go and see the performance. He had his own, which I may read about, you know, philosophy of dance. You're absolutely right. These were not only very specific, exact, almost unforgettable, detailed descriptions of any given performance, but also he was working toward some sort of theory of ballet, some theory of dance, so that whether people do this now, I think they do. I think there are whole schools now of, you know, performance theory,
mm-hmm.
But they may be a little more removed from the everyday actual writing about performance that he did when he literally went to the theater. Let me read, and this will give you, it's really on the first page in the book. It was his opening salvo. It was a theoretical article called Dance as a Solemn Ritual. It will be about 20 lines, and then I'll talk a bit about it. In ballet literature from Jean-Georges Nevers to Carlo Blasis to the present day, there has not been one attempt at making sense of the vast mosaic of forms or at parsing them and explaining in a comprehensive, sustained, and logical way their conceptual thematics and the full variety of their intellectual and emotional features. And yet there is not a pa without a thought behind it. Or, to put it more accurately, every pa in ballet, because of its combination of lines and movements, carries with it a specific idea from the world of the soul and the imagination, which at times ascends infinitely over its trivial content, as this content is set forth in the libretto. I'm just going to interrupt myself now. On the one hand, he's talking about codifying the art of dance into some general theory. On the other hand, behind every pa, there is an idea. So dance is not only of the here and now, but it is also of a higher reality.
Mm-hmm. And on the other also, hand, and he's also talking about a way to begin to understand what it means to look at a dance and not to be, let's say, unnecessarily distracted by the story. He says the libretto. That's right. That's what he means, is that he's trying to say, look, you're not going to be able to have a real experience with this stuff unless you think about how it's, yes, what's really going on here. And if that you think right. of this well, as just this step is just merely to express the whatever's going on the plot right now, you're going to not like ballet or appreciate it or really get into it. I mean, that's how I read that. Right.
Unique and wonderful about him is that he, at the same time, he is saying behind every pa, there is a thought. He is also writing the dance criticism on a very, shall I say, microcosmic, mm-hmm. immediate level, so that you feel that you are there. You understand. As a matter of fact, I have a quote here, which Joan Acacella published some years ago in the New Yorker, which I think beautifully appreciates exactly what Walensky wants dance critics to do. And this is what she said. I hope I can read my writing. If so much of life is spent in the difficult task of trying to understand things, to see through them, to see what's on the other side. Now, this is Walensky trying to do that. But the truth or the truths of dance are not on the other side. They are in the very bones of the dancer. They are very bones. They are the very bones which we need to learn how to read and understand if we allow ourselves to do it. I'm paraphrasing a bit. So that he's doing both. And if I can continue, you'll see exactly how he's doing it. There is a component of feelings and moods here. I think I skipped something. There's a component of feelings and moods here that cannot be translated in any other way than in dance. On point or demi-point, in gently languid arabesques, in the finest fabric of chimerical adagios. When the idea of ballet is expressed in simple language, the current attraction to it will become clear. Here, simple means visually precise, very lucid in terms of what is in front of you and what is important to notice. And here he goes on. This attraction relates not to ballet's plot, which in most cases is mediocre, not to its music, which is almost always irritating by virtue of its simplicity, not to the vulgar apparatus of its stage sets and costumes, but rather exclusively to the dancing itself and to the marvels of its plastique, its harmonious movement, and the brilliant illusion of its forms. We don't always acknowledge this with complete comprehensibility, but it is so. Dance is beautiful in and of itself, but when such powerful talents as Anna Pavlova and Matilda Kshesinskaya, or such perfect classical ballerinas as Vera Trefilova swirl on stage, or when Olga Preobrazhenskaya, with her enormous sense of rhythm, gives herself over to the silent music of movement, the phenomenon of dance arises before us in all its genuine significance. Before I read the last sentence or the last two sentences, I want to parse this because I think it gets to the heart of this enterprise. I don't know whether I would never have appreciated, of course, I don't know whether people who care about dance, except scholars of dance, really understand that the importance of the choreographer, the importance of the dancing itself, as something to write about, as something to think about, is a fairly modern, it's certainly a 20th century phenomenon, and it may have begun with Balanchine in the 20s. Velinsky predates this. When Velinsky was writing this, this is 1911, people, if you think of Diaghilev, people were fussing about music, Stravinsky, sets, Rerich, or some of Benoit, or Bakst, the costumes, and the dancing was, sure, it was part of the production, but it was not privileged. What Velinsky is calling for, and I'm going to read in a few minutes his lovely piece about his vision of the new choreographer. What Velinsky is saying, this is revolutionary, is that it is the dance itself which is important. You can strip it from everything, mm-hmm. and Balanchine basically did. Forget the sets, forget the scenery, forget the music, the libretto. Oh, yeah, they have to be there. But let's talk about dance as the supreme art if we're going to a ballet performance and not forget about it. And that's number one. Number two, he goes on and says, of course, I'll read it again. We don't always acknowledge this with complete comprehensibility, but it's now, dance is beautiful in and of itself. But when such powerful talents as, and of course, what comes next? A string of women. Well, Balanchine, some years later, said, dance is woman. For Velinsky, and this also is quite revolutionary, and it was quite wonderful, the essence of the dance enterprise is the ballerina, not as an object of lust or desire, which is probably true nowadays. A lot of people go and they want to see the beauty of the body for its own sensuous reasons. But because the woman's body is the mechanism which in a way carries us to the higher level. And so he is interested in these women. And of course, he's interested in them. I'll put it another way. He is the dance of these women, or the dancing of these women that he is interested in, is important and beautiful, not only in terms of its technical qualities, which he was very smart about, but also because of the personality, the biography, the quality of the dancer herself. This is very important. You don't only look at dance as acrobatics, as stunning feats of physicality. That it is. Some is better, some is worse. And he knew immediately, he had a terrific eye. He could go to a performance and tell you right off the bat, is it good or not? You just see it. You don't even have to be an expert. But what he really is interested in on another level, which is inseparable, is who is the person doing the dancing? She has a background. She has a life. She has a person, an identity. And he became very interested and wrote these portraits of dancers, some of which are in the book, of these dancers as women. Of course, nowadays you read a lot of these biographies or autobiographies of Allegra Kent, or Tony Bentley has one, or God knows Karsavina had one. But this is new. This is very new. And that's here as well. And of course, the final sentences are among my favorite, because I think not only do they say a tremendous amount, but they give you a sense of his poetic language, his use of metaphor, his use of just alliteration and style. Of course, in English, you get a little less of this. Passions without any clamor are heard through the mechanics of forms, which magically replace one another on stage. You've got to read that several times. Mm-hmm. The quivering of flight, the whirlwinds of double and triple tours, the boundless enthusiasm of the technically almost unfathomable fouilleté. A whole new world unfolds before our eyes, grandly, delicately, and in the glow of a kind of higher mathematics of correctness and charm. This is, again, I care about language. This to me is so evocative, mm-hmm. so fascinating. And in a way, it is a capsulized form, in some senses, of why he was so talented. He could give you the higher mathematics of form in photographic precision. He could just give you all of the technical qualities of a movement that he had seen. The fact that he didn't have a video camera, the fact that he didn't have a DVD or a Laserdisc or whatever we call it now, and had to go home and from memory render these steps in his reviews is to me, I mean, as my students say, awesome. I cannot imagine it, but he did that. But not only do you get the higher mathematics of form, but you get also the enthusiasm, the whirlwinds, the poetry, passions without any clamor, the noise, the body is noisy. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't speak, but what it does has a language. And he was able to fathom that language. So he combines almost a physics and a poetry, if you like, a mathematics and rhapsody. I just find that extremely attractive and certainly challenging to read and learn from. So that was the one passage. Mm-hmm. I could read another. Again, he was, to some extent, a prophet, a seer. The problem with him was he was much better at telling you what needed to be done. He was much better at criticizing the shortcomings of what was the kind of academic frozen form of dance. And he was even very good about predicting what the future might look like. But when actual examples of the future were put in front of him, he resisted. He became very conservative. So, for instance, he saw the young Balanchine as a dancer, and he kind of liked him as a dancer, and he wrote a nice piece about him. But when he saw Balanchine, just before Balanchine left, he choreographed a work called Dance Symphony, and Walensky went to see that, and he was horrified, mm-hmm. just horrified. And when I read this piece, I'm going to read just one paragraph of it, called Myth and Fairy Tale. You will see that on the one end, he is predicting Balanchine. He's literally, and the dancers who have read this and have gotten in touch with me or have written about this said, it's amazing. This guy is about a few years off. This is Balanchine. On the other hand, I am sure that if Walensky went and saw a Balanchine performance, he would die. He would find things wrong with it.
Can I ask you something about this? I had written a question about this, and then I had second thoughts about it because it seems to be the kind of stretching for comparisons that's dangerous, and especially seems like when people talk about Russians.
Yeah.
But it did strike me that Walensky was very good at describing, analyzing, and not so good at accommodating his views
Absolutely.
To the actuality.
Absolutely.
Do you, and of course that brings to mind some, you know, political examples in Russian history, you mm-hmm. know, that of mm-hmm. people who were very good at analyzing the problem, but not so good at coming up with solutions that didn't involve highly destructive behaviors. Of course, you know, Walensky's, the consequences of him not liking something were not the same as the consequences of, but do you see any kind of particularly Russian tendency in this, or is that something you want to stay away from?
Well,
because I have mixed feelings about that kind of way of talking about.
Yeah.
I couldn't help but think that there is something typical about this behavior, you know, that of coming up with these right. grand ideas and systems, and then getting very frustrated when people come along and don't behave right. the way.
Well, in Walensky's case, again, let me try to be clear about this. I think one of the things that liberated him, and it was the very thing that confined him, was his enormous knowledge of an appetite for culture. He saw things in such a huge, wide context, so he could not glamorize it in a negative sense, but he could valorize it in this world cultural sense, which I think you mentioned earlier. That same knowledge of and commitment to culture, meaning dance was part of it, and aesthetics was important, and if that's the case, we must go all the way, was the very ball and chain that kept him from moving fully into the future. He was, in a way, a product, a visionary, who was a slave to, and I would say this about any, the limitations of his own vision. His vision had a lot to do with, and this was cultural, we're all a product of our culture. And although he went against the grain of his culture, in many of his criticisms about what was wrong. Mm-hmm. He finally couldn't fully transcend it. And the way I see this most of all is his absolute fidelity to and pig-headed loyalty to Greek Hellenic culture mm-hmm. as the wellspring of dance. Well, that just is not true. Now, he had these remarkable theories, and some of his conclusions are, frankly, fascinating. You don't have to agree with them because they're crazy, but they really are, you know, Greek sculpture and the beauty of the body and all things in white.
Well, so there's one passage where he talks about how it's better that all the heads are off.
That's right.
Which is a beautiful passage. It's better. It'd be worse if you could see the heads. Right. It's good that you can only see the
but
bodies.
But he was wrong about this. He was wrong. And so he really did have he got caught in, as I said, maybe all ideologies finally are limited by the need to codify them. And he certainly codified his in a way which he couldn't overcome. Mm. So in a passage like this, which I'm going to read, he is, as I said, I think it is best poetically, linguistically, and intellectually. He really can feel the lack of excitement and energy and innovativeness in the world of dance. And he's looking and he knows what is needed. What is needed is a brilliant choreographer. But when the brilliant choreographer came, now Walensky was dead by then, but he had seen some of these modern, he wouldn't have gone near it. He got scared, I think. Mm-hmm. Anyway, this is a wonderful passage. I love translating it. And it's shorter than the last one. In his designs and, by the way, ballet master here is the word that he uses, and historically it is the proper word. We would now call this person a choreographer, but I didn't want to use a word that for him meant something else. In his designs and compositions, the ballet master of the future will inevitably turn to the rich and lively sources of folklore, with all its supplementary material provided both by the individual and the culture at large. Nothing must contain him, neither time nor space. All modern life, with its new ideas and new historical tasks, with its new aesthetic taste and new achievements in science, is at the service of the ballet master. Only one thing is required here, and this constitutes the heart of the matter, that he look at the world with the big, bright eyes of the storyteller. There has to be in him a little of the old woman who is knitting a stocking and endlessly threading fine stitches on her sharp hook. By the way, here is the literary. He cannot speak in any language other than metaphor. Mm-hmm. That I don't know.
It just makes the book so appealing.
It's just passages. A read. You don't have to care about mm-hmm. dance. You just read it. And I'm thinking, my God, what a way to describe a choreographer, anyone, but certainly a choreographer. I've never thought of it. So I'll go back. Only one thing is required here, and this constitutes the heart of the matter, that he look at the world with the big bright eyes of the storyteller. There has to be in him a little of the old woman who is knitting a stocking and endlessly threading fine stitches on her sharp hook. Theme after theme, figure after figure, loop by loop, stitch by stitch. The great fabric, now he's extending the metaphor mm-hmm. and realizing it, the great fabric of balletic art grows in the hands of the miraculous storyteller. He sees a heroic theme and softens it in his art. He encounters death and disperses its tragic spell, disclosing before our eyes the magic world of shades, which continue to exist somewhere and quiver with their earthly sighs. Not only are life's real horrors softened and reconciled, but everything is presented with a beauty that makes heroism desirable and amicable to man's prophetic heart. The ballet master storyteller represents the true educator of new generations, the so-called choreographic rhapsodist of modern times. He stitches together his own and others' themes, his own inventions and borrowings from the depths of mythology into a gold brocaded fabric that is dance, which raises to the stars any imagination that is the least bit lively and sensitive. The public loves classical dance precisely for its gratifying ease and heroic themes, which are presented through a naive and guileless story that partakes of sorcery. If the ballet master gives his own pathos to the story, if he is convinced that he is producing a conscious work of art, which pulls out of the depths of fantasy all its intuitive inferences, then he will unfailingly achieve the greatest results. I think Walensky speaks for himself in passages like these. They are prophetic. They are educational. He's trying to raise our cultural sensitivity and awareness vis-a-vis ballet. And I really, well, let me just tell you, why did this book happen? I was working on Walensky as a literary critic. I wrote a big article about him and included his whole life in that article because I felt he needed to be rediscovered. And so I wrote a 25-page article which covered all of his life, mostly as a literary critic, but the last few pages, of course, I included his career as a dance critic. And I published it, and the minute it came out, dance people got in touch. Oh my God, they said, we've heard flickerings about Walensky. You know, we know there was this man Walensky, and various people talk about him, but we don't know Russian, and we don't know how to get our hands on his work. And so I was asked to work on him, and I said, the only thing I might do is, just for fun, do some translating. And so I started translating, and I wrote a cover article, and I published this in a journal in Britain, which is still publishing, called Dance Research. And this caught on, and this has been the story of the book. It's been one person calling or writing and encouraging me after another.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you and hearing what you have to say. I can honestly encourage and urge people to look at this book and read it. It is such a pleasure to read it. The photographs.
Yeah, they are lovely.
The feeling for these great dancers, their lives come out. And I certainly hope that one way or the other we'll get more from you, either your own critical writing about this or translating or both. I'll just leave it by saying, because Stanley would never say this, his own writing in the introductions to this volume is so beautiful and accurate and thoughtful and interesting.
Thank you.
That alone is worth picking up the volume, and it's just been. I'm glad I also weirdly, not unlike Walensky, and you got kind of, you know, taken into this world without any thought to do it, and it's been a pleasure.
And, actually, that's criticism at its best. Can it infect and excite a person to go out? I mean, that's the purpose, mm-hmm. and not just implode and go inward, but really to go out and say, gee, I want to go to dance performance. I want to read that book again. I want to hear this piece of music again, because there's a lot there, and I see, you know, some of the things you can do to try to master it in your own way much better. So you're a perfect example of how this book has its own infectious power, and that is Walensky. It's certainly Walensky. So three cheers to him. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Stanley.